episode is a treat for all you fraud fighters interested in embezzlement and fidelity claims especially. We aren't stalkers because we are paid to be curious, but I stalked Dee Stoodler and you are going to be so happy I did. When I was speaking at the ACFE Central Indiana chapter this summer, of course I looked to see who else was speaking. I call that competitive intelligence, and I could not believe my luck. I just believe we were meant to meet. Dee Stoodler is our guest today. I got to the conference early and immediately introduced myself. I think she might have been a bit scared. Sometimes I get a bit excited. Dee is that person. You will understand by the end of this episode, and I'm sure you will be as excited as I was. She has a treasure trove of experience investigating fidelity claims, and with that experience comes the holy grail of embezzlement data. Let's get started. Hey, you guys, I can't tell you how excited I am to have Dee Stoodler on Fraudish today. And as I said in the intro, I stalked her. I thought that I found the holy grail. I showed up to an event early just to watch her, and I was just blown away. Part of the reason I was blown away is we kind of talk a lot the same. We hand out candy, and it was just like sisters from the same mother or something like that, or a different mother. But Dee, we're going to get started with a few word associations, and then you can give your Eiffel Tower spiel. How does that sound?
Oh, my. Okay.
Okay. When I say the word fraud, what do you think about?
Well, I think about that 70% of the people feel it's okay to commit some kind of fraud, and they'll usually rationalize it.
Ooh, 70%. Where do you get that number from?
Well, it comes from CFE in a lot of cases in the insurance industry that I work in, that 70, 75% of people feel it's okay to inflate their claim submission because they feel they've paid the insurance policy premiums, et cetera. But as I shared with you earlier, and I do have to do a little bit of disclaimer that my opinion doesn't reflect the opinion of the industry itself or SDC CPAs.
Yes, it is anecdotal, but I'm going to say you have a lot of experience to back up those anecdotes. Okay, so when I say the word ethics, what do you think about?
Ethics should be the person. You know, it's interesting. In our industry, we think of, can you tell your mother? Do you mind that it's published on the front of the paper? And, you know, is it something that you're willing to tell on your, you know, tombstone? And so if that behavior doesn't fit any of those three categories, I probably would define it as unethical. As you can determine, I'm a very black and white person in some ways, probably from all the years of dealing with white collar crime. It's all we do. So, yeah, I probably don't even trust my husband with my checkbook at this point. So,
Good point. I always have my own separate slush fund. That makes for a happy marriage.
Well, it is a lot of fun. My husband was 40 years of handling white collar crime on behalf of a carrier, and that's how I met him. So he probably thinks the same about me. So, yeah.
And who do you think makes better embezzlers, men or women?
Well, I once made a comment in the Wall Street Journal that women tend, I believe, to steal more. One, I don't know that we always catch it, but what's interesting is one study done by Hiscox Insurance found that women, based on their level in their professional life versus men, actually steal approximately 70% on average of the male. So, which is interesting, which reflects also the wages that we make as on an average in comparison to a male. So I thought that was an interesting statistic that Hiscox Insurance reflected in their study that was submitted to the Wall Street Journal.
Yeah. Yeah. And then last speed round sort of question, what is the best money you have spent since COVID?
Best money I've spent since COVID? Going to Portugal.
Oh, yeah.
Amazing place to go for a trip. Yes. Amazing. So totally enjoyed that vacation.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Amazing little egg tarts. And, you know, you just pop them in your mouth and they're so yummy.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. And my kids are actually getting their Portuguese citizenship.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So I will eventually spend some time in Portugal myself. I've been there before and I loved it.
Yes. Very wonderful people.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So now we're done with our speed round and you passed with flying colors, as I knew you would. The other thing that is, and I'll probably put this for the picture for the, when we drop the podcast, is you showed up the next day when I spoke in pink, and I appreciated that so much.
Well, it's only, you know, when you write, you wrote that how to detect and prevent and investigate pink collar crime. I mean, I got to reflect that, you know, I think I found the brightest pink shirt with sweater I owned. So
it was awesome. Totally awesome. So Dee, give the fraudish audience sort of your, you know, elevator speech.
My elevator speech on what I do, my life and passion.
Yeah.
Well, I work for insurance companies and I investigate white collar crime on behalf of various insurance companies because many, many people, when they own a business, they have a coverage called, we call it fidelity. Some people call it employee theft, employee dishonesty, computer fraud, forgery, and alteration. So we actually provide coverages to business owners and businesses worldwide through the insurance industries. And we measure and calculate and investigate those claims on behalf of insurance companies. So that's what we do. So I'm very lucky to learn so much from so many people and be in so many businesses and have an opportunity to visit and see what people do and make. And unfortunately, there's always a financial victim involved. And hopefully I can help them out. Not everybody's always happy, but we do the best we can.
And so as a small young child, did you ever think you'd do this type of work?
That's a loaded question. This is when my lawyers go, "Nah, be quiet, Dee. Be careful about that." I think I'm lucky in that I've always liked to test the systems. So I'm the person, if I was to go work at McDonald's, how could I push the limits? And so maybe it's best I'm on the other side watching how people push those limits and take advantage of the limitations and the breakdown in internal controls and accounting controls. And my gift, lack of a better word, is I can see them. I can see how they steal. I can see how they pushed it. And hopefully I do a good job in communicating it to the public so they can see it, and especially a jury and a judge, and tell the story so they can see it in their mind's eye of how it occurred and why it occurred and what gave them the opportunity. And that's what I find to be the passion, is to tell the story behind how it was done.
I truly believe, outside of psychopaths and sociopaths and narcissists, okay, that good people can make bad choices.
I think you are correct. And many times, you know, I heard a confession from a woman. It was taped, but she started stealing when her husband's medical bills due to his amputation of his leg due to diabetes or something. And she wanted to buy him the nicest prosthesis possible. And she recalled that because many times people remember the first time they steal. And that was her memory recall on this is why I stole the first time. So it gave us that point of time when she started stealing. But the reason why, of course, I don't know if you want to say rationalized it, but, you know, good people were forced to do something for the ones they love. And that does happen, I believe.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think you heard when I was doing my presentation, when we were together this summer, that I've done work with Dr. Linda Grounds, and she is a forensic psychologist. And she says, always ask about the first time. It's like, you know, your first kiss. Mine's mm-hmm. name was John. Ask me number 5 and I'm going to have to say no. I can't remember. So, and since the lawyers are going to listen, I won't ask you that question, Dee. Do you have like either a favorite case that you can talk about, or like a theme that kind of comes up regularly that you can talk about, you know, more generically?
Oh, I always remember the worst cases, not the best cases, unfortunately. I think what it's so fascinating is I literally will get a call on a claim, and you would think about a company that makes something with ball bearings, something a little round circle, solid stainless steel, brass, whatever it may be. And the employees are stealing the little ball bearings just to take them to the scrapyard to get some money. And you're like, holy moly, who would have thought I'm going to learn all about ball bearings, how many ball bearings go in, whatever it goes in. And then what's the normal use? How many are used? How many are left in the factory or the facility? And how many should there be? And how many was stolen? So I find that fascinating. I'm going to learn all about ball bearings. And I never thought I would learn about ball bearings. I think one of the funniest claims I ever ran into, was the fact that there were individuals stealing semi-trucks. Now, what I mean by this is the semi-trailers, the flat part where the heavy metal on the bottom and the axles and everything. And they decide to steal these. They're worth about $7,000 in today's a used beat up one. But they would literally spend hours using a welder, cutting them up in half and in quarters and cutting and cutting and cutting. And it took an average about 8 hours with two or three guys cutting them up, from what I remember. And then they would go to the scrapyard with all this stuff and sell it for $300 to $400. And I was thinking, that is so much work for $300 to $400. If you just went to a regular job, you would have made the same amount of money. And I thought, and it's just, it was so labor intensive. I just thought that was so, I guess it's the CPA in me. It was like cost versus benefit, the risk analysis. It just didn't make sense. And that always has stuck in my mind. It's, wow, come on, people.
So do you think, and, you know, we can go anecdotally, or if you have some sort of numbers to back this up, since COVID and since, you know, this oncoming recession that we constantly are hearing about, that fraud is going to increase? And why would it increase because of COVID or the recession, in your experience?
Oh, that's a great question. For me, it's an easy one. So what happens during good times? COVID was unusual. It's something that in our industry, where literally businesses were shut down, people were not going into branches or anything. Our amount of losses submitted to the insurance companies dropped like a rock. I mean, it was slow for the crime world. Now, what went up during that period, and I can talk about a little bit, it was what we call cyber losses. This is what you call social engineering. We all get it, is that little email that says, oh, you just won the lottery. Just give me $100 and I'll send you your million that you won in the UK lottery. Those ridiculous emails we all get, and they get you scammed and they get you hooked and you continue sending them money. Those we call cyber or social engineering claims. Those, of course, were on the increase, but for many reasons, not even people who are trying to make money. We had the misinformation of, you know, the Russian in Ukraine and North Korea and so many other actors. So that, to me, I'm going to pull aside, because that during COVID and during the Ukraine war is just increased ridiculously. But in our industry, it's very known, and we're very comfortable with this. What we see during recessions is an escalation. So what happens is, during good times with a business is making money, very profitable. Somebody's stealing a little money out of the back door, stealing a little inventory. We're making so much money, we don't notice it. As the business is cranking along, all of a sudden we go into a recession or a slowdown. All of a sudden they're starting to look through the books and records, through the inventory, where can we make cuts? They discover these losses. The rate of discovery escalates, that our claim count goes up, and that happens during recessions with us a lot. So 78, 2001, 2008, and now today we have another escalation that's been happening for the last 5 months. So we will have anywhere from 50 to 100%, 200% increase in the claim submissions for white collar crime. And literally, I remember August of 2008, I'm looking at everybody going, why is everything like increasing? What is going on? And literally, I think it was late August, early September, Madoff was announced. And then after that, it was just We were like chickens with our heads cut off, running around with not enough time and not enough people. So that's what we're going into right now. The types of claims are a little bit different than we saw in 08, but we do have a great significance going on right now.
What do you think remote work has to do with that, if anything? Because I know Doug Karp, who you know, on in Hiscox stated it's, you know, remote work makes it easier.
I would agree with Doug. So the remote work makes it easier in that there's less oversight. But what really right now is the lack of staffing and lack of oversight. We have less people to literally, you know, divide up the job duties and the responsibilities. And we have one or two people doing everything with a lack of segregation of duties. And that is really scary as to what is going on there. So that's our big concern right now.
So the lack of oversight and the lack of staffing, do you think that can also lead to the rationalization that, like, I'm doing the job of two people right now because the company laid off three people in my department?
I'm getting less rationalization. I'm overworked. But what I'm seeing is I have a gambling habit. Gambling is becoming a significant amount of it. And you're going to laugh. I have a trend here recently. We have two trends kind of going on right now. I thought I'd mention to you. We've had a significant increase in fuel losses. I mean, people pulling up in the middle of the night, overriding the fuel pumps and just sucking the fuel dry, or they're just pulling up to the manhole cover and sucking it dry right out of the tanks. So it reminds me of 70s and 80s when fuel prices were record high. Instead of sucking it out of the car, we just go to the gas station and suck it out of their tanks. So yeah, we're getting a lot of that. And also people, the employees are involved in that they release the locks on the fuel pumps and then their friends are driving up to the pump and getting free gas. So we're getting a lot of those, unfortunately. So fuel is interesting and it's in direct comparison with the price of fuel. Isn't that kind of fascinating? The second thing we're getting is Frank Abagnale. I never say his name right.
Abagnale, yeah.
Thank you. Catch me if you can. He would be proud of all of us right now. We have record amount of forgery and alteration. The ability to take a bank account number and routing number. This is so important. And we've talked about this in the news. People are stealing mail left and right. I'm sure we've all heard the stories and seen the stories. Nets are being put in mailboxes where the mail is caught by the thieves and they take it out. And what's happening is they're taking checks. They're going to any check-producing company, taking the bank account, routing number, using any type of electronic means, put that, you know, signature on there. And we have just got forgery and alteration claims are increasing very, very significantly. And the means to do it is so much easier. The thing I can recommend to everybody is please have your people take the mail directly to the post office. And that is so important. Do not use mailboxes. Don't even trust your mail carrier to pick up your mail because so many of them are independent contractors. And you just really never know. And just take the time to go directly to the post office is the best thing to do there.
Okay, so this is, I was just teaching a college accounting class the other night or the other day. And my kids who are 23 and 25 have never written a check in their life. They wouldn't know how. They can deposit them all day long. Like, yep. Sure. Do you see an age difference in theft in the means?
Well, by the means, or do you mean, I haven't, it's the means. It's interesting. I've seen another trend that's kind of going on is my older people on our claims, they'll rationalize it and they'll conceal it. They actually take the time to think, how am I going to do this? And how am I going to get by with it? And how do I avoid discovery? What I've got with these younger people, I've seen about a dozen cases here recently, just in the last year. They've been, when I say last year, 2023, I kind of have to think back to October to now, to the, what is it? Almost February.
Almost February.
All right. So what we're seeing is that these young kids are stealing as though it's a video game. They just steal the money outright, don't even bother concealing it, and they just want to buy. I have one that had rented a Ferrari. He's 22. Do you not think the company's going to get a little, like, suspicious? So it was just like, oh, yeah, I got money from my parents kind of thing, you know. And he just stole it. And when he was arrested, he was in shock. And he didn't understand that he was going to jail. And they have an idea that they can just push the start button or restart button and restart the game. And so the concept of just stealing $500,000 in 6 months, this very short time period, because it's a game, right? It's a video game. We're just going to shoot them up and take it all. And it's very fascinating. I've never seen this attitude of not even bothering, like it's a wrong thing. And yeah, it's, to me, it's fascinating. It's scary.
And is that partially because maybe the economic, I'm going to say Grand Canyon, they're like, I'm never going to get to the other side, so I might as well enjoy it while I can.
Was it worth it when you sit 5 years in jail? I don't know. You know, and unfortunately, parents are very forgiving in this generation. I've seen so many parents step up and try and save their child from a lot of restitution is being made by parents, not the person that stole. And that's a different realm too. A lot more parent involvement in trying to pay it back. So that's different.
That's interesting. What is your experience in restitution? Because I, you know, hashtag no one steals to save.
I've actually had some save. And so it's kind of nice. My best restitution story is that we had somebody stealing from a financial institution, stole quite a lot of money, but they also ended up winning the Powerball. So they paid it all back at one point in the future. It was Powerball or some big lottery out west. But yeah, they ended up paying it all back. And it was kind of funny. It was the 1 year some insurance company had a negative loss ratio. In other words, they had recovered all the money stolen.
Oh my gosh.
It was like, hey, that's a pretty good ratio. How does that make sense though? So that's a good one.
But, okay, so in that case, I'm curious because I joke that, like, okay, say Betty, who steals from the dentist, mm-hmm. and she's got a raging gambling issue, and she does say hit it big. Is she going to go to the dentist and say, here's the $1 million I stole? And mm-hmm. is the dentist going to say, okay, well, I'll take it, but I'm still calling the cops on you?
You know, and I really don't recommend people do that. Don't settle with these individuals without at least telling your insurance company, right? Because the probability you might, you know, prejudice your rights under the recovery of the policy. I definitely get your lawyer involved. That's my recommendation. I don't understand. People don't want to call the officers either, or the authorities. I just had one yesterday. I'm like, what do you mean you're not going to call the police or let them know? And they're not required. And a lot of people don't understand this. Under the majority of crime claims or policies, you're not required to put the authorities on notice for, I believe it's forgery and alteration and employee theft. So employee theft, the reason why we don't require police being contacted is the loss of reputation. And you don't want to require somebody to do something to lose their reputation just to get payment from an insurance company. So often it's not required, but we do pursue people civilly if we do pay under the policy. But restitution is fascinating in that we expect about 15% recoveries in our industry. So we have professionals that go after them. And that's how we were able to get on that lottery, is they really go out and watch them. And I hear stories in our industry where people know they have kids and they'll sit in front of their house, say Christmas Eve, waiting for them to show up at their kid's house. I mean, so there's some real professionals in our industry that really dedicate their entire, you know, day to finding these people and trying to recover. And, you know, I told you my husband worked at Travelers. Whoops, I didn't say that. He worked at an insurance company for many years. And I remember he always used to complain, oh, this one guy sends me $50 every month. I have to process the $50 payment from jail. So to him, it was a lot of paperwork, but it adds up over time. So, you know, it's kind of cool. So I just had someone that's paying $1,000 a month to steal $15,000. So you kind of wonder, why were you doing that? But the threat that's overriding him is actually being, what's the word I'm looking for? Unfortunately, extradited or sent out of the States. So he's scared of that. So he's trying to pay back the owner of the gas station immediately. So that's his incentive to stay in the States.
Well, okay. So this, when you talk with the victims, what is there a common thread? I mean, a lot of them, it's shame and humiliation, but is there another sort of common thread that you think the audience might be interested in, that the victims cry on your shoulder instead of the lawyer's shoulder because you're nicer?
I'm not giving them legal advice at every second. Yeah. It really is two things. I trusted them. And many times when a professional, and I'm just going to pick on a dentist or a doctor, they're so good at their skill set and they're passionate about their surgery or their dentistry practice, and they have no desire to do the books and records. And when you have somebody who's willing to do it all for you, they are so willing to do all of it for you, including spend your money for you. So it becomes easy to let somebody do something you're not happy to do. And we all fall into that trap sometimes. So for me and my husband, I don't take out the garbage. That's in our marriage contract. I do not take out the garbage. But at the same time, I can't tell him when to take out the garbage.
As long as it gets out by garbage collection day.
So it's really two traps that owners get into. They trust people. And they literally give them the things they don't desire to do. Rarely does an inventor, an engineer, a passionate doctor go, oh, yeah, let me balance the checkbook today and let me look at my bank statement. So and that's for a small business. That all I recommend is one thing. Get your bank statement sent to your home. While you're eating your Wheaties in the morning or a cup of coffee, just look at it and spend the extra $3 to get the little microfiche copies of the checks, if you write checks. And don't get me, you know, we can talk about what I think about ACH and checks at a little bit too. And I highly recommend, I do a throw out here, a shout out to having you have Ron Mond and Dolores Parr speak about the difference between ACH and checks. And that for business owners, there's actually UCC differences between commercially reasonable recovery times on an ACH versus a check. And I think that would make a good chat for a lot of your business owners and individuals out there to understand. It's kind of like a credit card. I'd rather have a credit card than a debit card because I can always complain to the credit card company and get my money back. When somebody takes all the money out on your debit card, your chances against the bank under UCC are much more difficult. I can do with a horrendous balance on my credit card and argue with the credit card company for 30 days. I don't know if I could do much in 30 days when I have no money left in my bank account. So I think that's a lot of things you have to think about, you know? So yeah, there are those differences.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. So the ACH and the checks, like when I was talking the other day to this class, you know, the students were like, yeah, we don't write checks. And I was actually at a store the other day and a woman like my age, and you know, I'm not a spring chicken, but she pulled out a checkbook and I was like, what are you? I think it was Costco. I was like, what are you doing? Like checks, really? Like, I mean, do you roll your eyes when you see someone at the grocery store pull out a check?
Oh boy. I am a check writer and proud to be a check writer because I know if my check is forged as an ordinary citizen who hasn't signed all their rights away to the bank, I have, you know, upon knowing that I get a forged check in the mail and I'm finding it, but you do have to look at your check statements every 30 days. I have the right to recover, and it's the bank's responsibility. Doesn't matter how good or how many times it was copied or created. That's not upon me as a personal individual. And on a business, there's commercially reasonable. And like I said, I'm not a lawyer, but I've been trained by the lawyers that, you know, are at this company, as well as many others, that it is the check that we will stay with because we have better rights of recovery when things go wrong. And ACH is gone, and rarely do you have time to tell the bank in time and get your money back. It's gone. A wire is even worse. ACH is 2 days, I believe, and a check is 30 to 60 days, depending on if it's a personal account or a commercial account. I'll take my odds on the check.
Okay. I have certain bills that I pay by check for sure. Like I have certain ones that I do, but like when I go to Costco, I put it on my credit card.
Now, I'm certainly a credit card. Everything, I can pay it by credit card. I will pay it by credit card because that is the best secured way to do it because your ability to recover if there is a mischarge. And that to me is the best way because I always can see it. You have the ability to call and demand a charge back, et cetera. So I am more into getting it on the credit card first. It gives me even a greater amount of time to see if there's any fraud going on.
So when you come across a claim, do you think they stick with one method or they start with one and then they see, oh, well, I did this on the expense report and I can do it on this and I can do a fake vendor? Like, how does that work for your work product? Do you go in with one way or how does it work for you?
Well, normally, and it's interesting, I think they have two attitudes when it starts. One, something they did, like they used the wrong credit cards here. So they used the wrong credit card. They used the company credit card to charge a dinner rather than their own credit card. And it was an accident. Normally when that happens to 90% of us, the company calls us up and says, what's this dinner you had on a Saturday night? Is that really ours? Oh, I'm so sorry. I thought it was on my personal card. And they'll go ahead and get it caught. But sometimes when it goes unnoticed, nobody noticed. Nobody notices. I'll do it again and again and again. And so it just escalates. If you get by with that, that's great. It's hard when you only have that ability to use multiple schemes to conceal stealing money. So you may be stuck in the one lane highway to doing theft, right? But if you're in a position like a controller or a CFO, you may do different things. If I'm at a car dealership and I'm the accounts receivable clerk or in the accounts payable or I have multiple roles, I might write off AR. I might utilize the petty cash. I might write extra payroll checks out to myself. I might utilize different things to get money out. Now, the second category is not the mistake ones. They come in and they start stealing right away. And what's fascinating is I find those to be the ones that came in from somewhere else. They looked around, made sure they can continue stealing at this employer, and they just continue going. So going back to that police and putting people on notice that they've been stealing from you, that is so important in this day and age because they don't stop. I'm sorry. If you don't put the police on notice and give them a background, at least a criminal charge, I can run a background check, but it's a waste of money and time because the prior employer never bothered calling the police. And that's the real shame. And so they'll go literally from one car dealer to another car dealer to another car dealer. And it's just very frustrating when people say, well, I don't want to put them on notice. I want them to be employable so they can pay the money back. I'm like, no, I don't want the money back for that because I'll just end up with another claim at another car dealer. So, no.
Yeah. Well, I got in trouble when I worked at the sheriff's office because I wanted the public information officer to put out press releases. And he's like, they're boring. We'd rather show a kid crashing into the Jack in the Box at 2 a.m. in the local newspaper. And I'm like, okay, first off, not a deterrent. Kids don't read newspapers back then. And I'm like, there's this thing, it's called the Google effect, the tail effect. Once their name is in print, because I had done over 1,000 backgrounds and it's like, yeah. So I got banned from same press release because they found the stories. They're like, they're boring. And I'm like, they are a deterrent and they're also educational.
Yep.
So Oh, go ahead.
I was going to say, I had a loss. It was funny. This guy was stealing for years. I forget what the company did, but it's funny that he had a coworker that didn't like him. And so he looked him up on Google for some reason, the internet. And he found out he had a criminal record in Los Angeles, of all places, at another company. And he really didn't like this guy. So he went and told his manager, who then told, I don't know, the assistant general counsel. And so they decided then to look at the guy just to make sure if it was the same guy. They sent somebody down to the courthouse to poll the entire court record. Oh, yeah, it is the same guy. Maybe we should look at his work. They looked at his work, and lo and behold, you know, $5 million later, they decided they had a problem. So yeah, it does work. It really does. So
my biggest Yeah, my biggest cases are from tips. And people, you know what? There's Schadenfreude. And there's also FOMO. It's like, why does that person get to drive a brand new, you know, Range Rover? And I'm driving my crappy Corolla. No offense to Corollas. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, my biggest cases have come from tips.
Yep.
And if we don't protect those people, the tips won't come in. Hey, now, we talked about this because I showed Dee my little treat book that I got from 1937, 1001 Embezzlers. And she was fascinated. And I was fascinated that she didn't know about it because it's so old. It's practically 100 years old. You've been keeping track of everything you investigate.
Right.
Is there some like warning or public service announcement you can give, like, this industry you people need to pay more attention to, like maybe education? Or is there, because I know you keep track of that. Like, is there some, besides dentists, 3 out of 5 dentists get ripped off?
Car dealers and auto parts. Not only do I say it, but the FBI also say that is the highest risk industrial-wise. I read an old study when I was at University of Texas that had the highest rate of employee theft. And that's true. We get so many claims submitted by the car industry, auto parts, anything related to a vehicle. There's so many opportunities to steal, from the down payment of the purchase of the car to the finance and insurance guy creating something. We're now getting, what we're getting a lot of is bogus buyers. Buyers coming in with their fictitious, fraudulent, forged cashier's checks. They get the title, they get the car, and the cashier's check is bogus. And there's no asset to go after because we don't even have the car. And so they go over state lines. We can't even go get the car anymore. And it's just a real challenge. And who knows, by then it's probably parted out. So it's just the reality of it. It's the auto industry. And I don't mean the auto industry, the big, you know, the big three, GM, et cetera, that I'm talking the average auto dealer, part distributor. That's where it's happened. Use the auto, you know, cars, everything. We get bogus. I mean, people come in as a customer and I really want to sell the car as a salesperson. Well, Katie, you say you make $35,000. I can't get you a car loan for that. You really make $135,000. Let me put that on your app for a loan. And we get everything from that just to get that commission and get the selling out. It's just really bad. I've got employees that create the inventory that they have in the parts department so they can push up the gross profit, which gets them a higher incentive on the year-end bonus. And it's just everywhere in the car industry. So that's my big, that's a big bad one.
Oh, that's interesting. Because now, I mean, you probably couldn't say it even if you did, but there was a woman, Patricia Smith, who stole from an Acura dealership in Pennsylvania.
Okay.
She was flying private. She made like $53,000 a year. And flying private, barefoot Contessa lunch, you know, for $32,000. People were curious and they did ask her, how do you get a travel like this? And she's like, oh, we're blessed. I got a side hustle. And so they were curious, but In her case, she saw this really wealthy family that owned a lot of car dealerships, and she thought they were happier than her family.
Oh.
And she ended up going to prison. I wrote to her in prison. It was kind of fun, but then she dissed me. But people think, and is this your experience or not? People think money solves every problem. Like the woman with the buying her husband a better prosthetic.
I think that, but sometimes I think they're really desperate. And a lot of desperate is the gambling debt. Oh my gosh, the fact that you have to tell your spouse or family, I've got a problem. And it's so addicting. And I'm just finding that's a tough one. So that's a tough question, Katie. You know, I kind of, sometimes they know and sometimes they don't know why they're doing it. And in the subconscious and the conscious and the rationalization can just be, I think that's why I love this industry is the mind is so powerful on why you are ethical or unethical, why you push the line and not push the line. Why do I get the thrill of, I'll never forget, I was in an airport and I go to one of those yogurt places, TBCY, and it was late at night. And I'm looking at, and they're trying this, they took my money for what I wanted, right? A big scoop of vanilla ice cream, that's what I like. And they took my money, but they didn't open up the cash register. And I'm looking at the cup they give it to me. It says bait and tackle on it. You little craps. I mean, I was like, I literally went down and got the police officer at the security company. I said, you know, they've closed down the register for the day. And they're not using the cups that are the companies. They're stealing product and selling it for cash. And it was about 3 hours before they closed down for the night, but that was pure revenue into their pocket. They had shut down the register for the owner of that little yogurt shop, their small businesses. But that's what I get the passion of saying, you craps, I can see what you're doing. And that's what excites me is the behavior of that. And it was three people working together on this. One of them probably got the bait cops, you know? But yeah, it's just, I just, how, why they think they're going to get by with this. And I was very vocal. I'm like, what do you guys think you're doing? This isn't a TBCY yogurt cup. This is something you bought at Sam's or something. And I was embarrassing them. And I looked at everybody and Ryan, I'm like, do you realize they're ripping off the owner? They don't even have the register open.
Yeah.
And I walked down to security.
And they probably had a little sign. But cash only, credit card machine down.
Yeah, but they don't even pop the register open and ring up the sale.
Well, so, you know, there's one fast food restaurant that's, you know, Chinese, Panda Express. And it says very much, if you don't get a receipt, your meal is free.
Free. Yep.
Yeah. And, you know, my kids are like, what's that all about? And I'm like, oh, well, let me explain to you. So this actually leads into, and then we'll kind of close it down. But in your experience, anecdotally, do people commit embezzlement on their own or in sort of like a group like the yogurt place?
Oh, no. They're on their own because it's an embarrassment, unethical. If you can't tell your parents, you can't do anybody. But sometimes every now and then, it's mostly women. I've never seen, I shouldn't say never. It's rare that you see two men, other than if it's like in a warehouse and they together and it's something big and they need their help, like cutting down semi-trucks. But the women sometimes will know that the other ones will do it. And they really don't talk about it. When I talk to them in an interview, they're just like, well, I knew she was doing it, but if she was doing it, I could do it kind of concept. Therefore, we're all going to keep our mouth shut, that passive collusion, not totally, hey, how much are you taking this week? How much are you taking? It was kind of like, well, I'll let you pay excess salary if you don't say anything about the excess time on my time cards kind of thing. So it was more of a passive collusion, we call it, versus active. And there is some working together by turning, you know, closing your eyes to the evil of it. And that's the interesting thing about that. I think it's more that, but mostly I would say 90% plus is really look, you know, working by yourself because you're embarrassed by your own real behavior in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
So, I don't know if that's what you find.
No, that's what I find.
What do you think, Kelly?
Oh, that's, yeah. You know, the one place that I see more collusion, again, anecdotally, because I go to sleep with Google alerts on embezzlement, are banks. It's like the junior teller sees the senior teller and then wants a piece of it. Mm-hmm. So it seems more like that, but it's all anecdotal that I see it more often. Okay. Do you like television, movies, things like that?
Oh, yeah.
Is there a white collar crime or a fraud movie or show that you could recommend? Or are you just like, oh yeah, this is great.
Oh, I should almost yell for, it's called Johnny Dollar, I believe. It's old radio. Johnny Dollar, the all paid expense report, investigator for the insurance company. And he starts off in New York City, just got out of cab, 5 cents for the expense report. Going into building to visit with so-and-so who's filed for a life insurance policy. He goes on through his day and it's all about his expense report and all his activity that's going to go on his expense report. But Johnny Dollar, the insurance investigator. And so he's always investigating, you know, fraudulent claims that are submitted. And it's very kind of cool. But for an insurance person that investigates, that's kind of one of our shows that we were like, of course, Double Indemnity. The insurance adjuster is a surgeon, you know, a psychologist. And that's one of the greatest crime claims or crime related or fraud films, I think, that there ever was. So you like that one too, don't you, Kelly?
Yeah. Yeah. And a friend of mine, unbeknownst to, you know, she sent me about a month ago, have you heard of Johnny Dollar? And I was like, oh, yes, I have, because of tea. Did you ever watch Leverage?
No, I don't think I have. Or if I did, I don't remember. But go share with us.
You should watch it. It's just, you know, it's fiction. It was filmed in Portland. But long story short, really good investigator, saved his insurance company millions and millions of dollars. He did very high-end claims, art, things like that. And the opening scene, and I won't give huge spoilers, but the opening scene, he's sitting in a bar, he's drinking, and some guy comes up to him and says, hey, I know your story. And he's like, you don't know my story. And he's like, it turns out his kid was sick with cancer. And the insurance company that he had saved tens of millions of dollars for denied the experimental treatment. And then it kind of becomes Robin Hood, and he puts together a gang. And there were like probably 5 seasons, and then Timothy Hutton got canceled. And, you know, now it's kind of a spinoff, but it was really, really clever, because there's a scene later that I show this in my Fraud and Pop Culture, where you see him explaining to his now ex-wife, who works for the evil insurance company guy, she didn't understand that. And it shows a flashback to the kid actually dying. Mm-hmm. And this is like a guy who loved his job as an investigator. But then when he considered that, you know, they didn't allow his son to at least attempt the, you know, experimental surgery or whatever it was. And so it's clever. I think you should watch it.
Yeah. And the only thing, if I could do a shout out to insurance adjusters and insurance investigators, I mean, we're rarely appreciated for the job we do for the stakeholders, whether it be the people who pay the premiums, so you don't pay excess premiums because we're just paying out claims for, you know, people who shouldn't receive money. If 70% of people think it's okay to inflate an insurance claim, that's kind of what we're looking at, right? Of course, the shareholders, and a lot of people don't realize the majority of their pension plans are actually invested in insurance companies. So it really has a bigger stake than people realize when the mentality is there. Well, it's like an annuity. Well, it's not an annuity. It's an insurance policy. And so I know we're the big bad insurance company. There are costs versus benefit. And unfortunately, as the black and white account, sometimes I have too much of that. And it's just a shout out to them. We do the best we can. But really, if I could do a shout out to everybody, when you're a car dealer or anybody, I know you're going to trust people. I know you're going to have labor shortages. Buy a little bit more Fidelity or crime insurance. It's so inexpensive. I mean, you could literally get $5 million in some places for a whopping $2,000 or something, depending if you're a low risk. but it's not, that's less than an employee cost. So in some ways you may have the loss, but at least you can mitigate or transfer the risk. And it's really decent to think about, because I would say, and you know, we talked about, we're going to update that 1001. I don't know if I told you, Kelly, we've taken on the project. We're going to update that book.
Oh my gosh.
Yes. Yeah, so we're going to call it 1001 Embezzlers Today or Embezzlements Today. We don't know. We got to change the name a little bit. But one of the categories we're going to study is the amount of these claims that are underinsured. There's guesstimates on it, but we would say anywhere between 50 to 70% of businesses are underinsured for crime. I just got done with a wine distributor on the phone today. Very sad case. They have a whopping, I think it's $50,000 in coverage. The wine stolen out of the warehouse that they're responsible to customers will probably bankrupt them in excess of $400,000. So if they had just had a $500,000 policy or $1 million policy, they wouldn't be under this stress as much. Yes, it's horrible when people steal, but we all realize that when employees do that, we have bad actors, right? So I if there's one thing that's easy and less expensive, is to think about extra crime insurance and get rid of the rosy-eyed glasses that I trust everybody and they would never do this to me. And that's not true. You make money, somebody's going to want to steal that money.
Yeah. Oh my God. I cannot tell you how excited I am. Okay. Your book, the cover must be pink.
It has to be pink. I was going to do purple.
No. It must be pink. I'm so excited because you know what? I have been looking, I have reached out to, I don't know how many people in the insurance industry, in associations, like, I have this book here. This is what I need. And when I saw you on the agenda for, where were we? Indiana. Uh-huh. I was like, she has the golden goose.
Well, and we've got 12,000. We call them files, but 12,000 submissions of claims involving white collar crime. So yeah, it'll be fun to go through the, some of those historically. And I'm sure, what did they say the average loss in this book was? I was laughing.
Dee's pulled out the book. Where did you find
out the book?
Wait, where did you find the book?
On Amazon. I bought every copy. Sorry.
Oh my God, that's so funny. I should be getting an affiliate payment for that.
Okay. The average man took $6,363. The average woman took $4,192. Well, that sounds familiar, doesn't it? And this is in 1937, put together by the United States Fidelity and Guarantee Company, USF&G. They're now owned by Travelers. It was funny. I talked to a friend of mine. He's retiring this February 21st. Shout out to Steve Kranz. He was at USF&G when it existed for years. And he didn't even know who Asbury Davis was that wrote that book. So
I truly think we were meant to meet.
I think so too.
I think we were meant to meet because there's no one that has the data besides the insurance companies.
Correct.
I just like, you know, and much as I love the ACFE, it is a survey. You guys have hard data and you have so much data. The fields, like you said, if it's underinsured, you have gender, you have industry, you have amount, you have, I don't
know.
How
long they were employed and what position they have. So yeah. And so, yeah, we're going to work on this. Hopefully we're going to have it out next couple of years. Probably always takes longer. We figured out the labor hours will be well in excess of 600 hours to just go through the data and get it in the spreadsheet. But we have spreadsheets. Unlike 1937, it was all handwritten in, you know, 13 column paper, probably with a 10 key calculator or whatever they had back then to figure out the percentages and the averages.
Oh my gosh. Okay. When you finish and probably before you finish, I want to have you back on because this is like for all the investigators out there, like this is the real money investigation, I think.
Oh,
like it is.
We're very below the radar. Below the radar.
So. Yeah. So, Dee, thank you so much. I can't wait to have you back and or your staff too.
Yeah.
Because you're doing the work that I think business owners must have. I did a case for a business owner, and they had a very good insurance policy. And the other thing is, and I don't know if this is true, I mean, the couple of the cases that I've done where insurance is paid, you got to have the investigative costs paid. Like,
Yes, there is a line you can ask for if you're a bigger company and have bigger limits. The investigative expenses is a really nice bells and whistles to it. What's more important today, more than ever, is fraudulent impersonation coverage. That's where somebody impersonates your vendor or client. And unfortunately, you think you're talking to your real vendor. You get that email, you owed on this bill, and you always worked with this vendor. Email looks right. And you send it to the new bank account or ACH account. And unfortunately, you're talking to somebody in Russia. And they just got, you're the vendor payment for that vendor. And now you've got an upset vendor who didn't get paid and you're out money. So that coverage is so necessary today and so hard to get. So it's very, very important coverage and very important. Remember I said I didn't like ACHs. Now you know.
Oh my gosh. This has been so awesome, Dee. Thank you so much. And you're going to be back before you even know it.
All right. Thank you.
Now you know why I was so excited. Dee is so amazing, and her experience doing these cases is unmatched. Well, maybe except for her husband, and he will be a future guest. Have you seen the book, or should I say pamphlet, we refer to? It is just so cute, and the stories are really very interesting. But it will be updated and hopefully in pink. Are you going to try and listen to Johnny Dollar and the talking about stealing gas? I just listened to a new podcast, The Economics of Everyday Things, and it was all about gas stations, and they even talked about stealing gas. I found that via Freakonomics. Have a great week. Read a book, listen to a podcast, and if you are so inclined, please leave a review. March is going to be a busy speaking month, but lots in store for the fraudish audience.